Yes. And that story can be found on page 320 in the sixth edition of the basic text. And we are going to have Roger, who is going to start off reading the story for us today.
Thank you, Tina. I'm Roger Manatic. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, you can. Thank you so much.
That's great. Thank you. I'm not so aware about the format yet, but it's I just wanted to say before I jump into straight into reading that it's a privilege and an honor to do, you know, to be asked to be of service in any little way in Narcotics Anonymous, the very thing that saved my life and so many. And, you know, and to be allowed to read this story is big for me and massive for me because, you know, this particular, you know, addict, Sumit, showed up in my life when I was 3 days clean. And he's been instrumental in me still, you know, being clean today and having a life that I would otherwise not have been able to have. So I'll get straight into the story. 320 on in the basic text. This Indian addict believes there are no bad days, only good days and learning days. And he has learned a lot in recovery. Perhaps most importantly, has learned how to love and to trust the process. Just say yes. I grew up in a traditional Indian Sikh family where even smoking cigarettes is taboo. The Sikhs are a martial people, and Sardar, the Indian word for Sikh, means leader. Because Sikhs can be identified by their turbans, I was a very visible user. A Sikh who smokes is a disgrace to the community, and I was using. Even the dealers called me Smaki Sardar. I lived at least two lives, my professional life and my addict life. I graduated from a very good school, though I had managed to get suspended for a year because on an impulse, I took off to the mountains with an urge to do mushrooms. In the beginning, I worked in go-getting corporate environments, and then because it became harder and harder to reconcile the demands of work with the needs of an addict, I went to teach in the mountains. My rationalization was that I didn't want to be in the rat race. I gave impassioned lectures to anyone who would listen about doing something meaningful, but I think what attracted me most was the laid-back lifestyle and the great marijuana that grew outside my cottage. A cottage on a cliff in a residential school was an easy place to isolate. At first it was fun, and then it became hellish. I couldn't handle the loneliness, so I went to the city to look for a job. With each switch, assimilating into the new environment got harder. From the beginning, guilt, shame, and fear were part of my using. I did many geographics in active addiction to get away from the people who loved me because I was unable to bear looking into their eyes, from the jobs I could no longer keep, from the friends I had let down. I thought if I changed my circumstances, I would finally get my life together. I believed that my problem was that I was just born in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was supposed to be a rock star in the 60s in California. Instead, I was an Indian computer software guy in the 90s. And you know the story. Ultimately, I couldn't keep juggling. For me, hearing that my life had become unmanageable was a relief. You had given my condition a name. I came to my first meeting like most addicts do, hopeless, desperate, and suicidal. I got there just as the meeting was ending. As I walked in, two people on either side grabbed my hand and said the serenity prayer. I learned an important lesson that day. Put one hand in the hand of a newcomer and one hand in the hand of an experienced member, and you don't have a hand to pick up. Outside the meeting, a man spoke to me and shared his story. He started saying things I had felt, things I hadn't told anyone. Finally, he described things I hadn't even told myself. But when I heard them, they resonated in the depths of my being. He had given voice to my feelings. Someone understood, and he said, "You never have to feel like this again. You never have to be alone again. Just keep coming back." He became my first sponsor. I haven't juiced since that day. The next day, I told my best friend, with whom I used for 10 years, that I'd been to a meeting and asked whether he'd like to come. I didn't know why I asked him, or more remarkably, why he said yes. I had my first successful 12-step call even before I knew there were 12 steps. Getting clean and staying clean with him has been one of all the pleasures of my recovery. Like many people, I came to NA an agnostic. When my sponsor asked me to pray, I said I didn't believe in God, and so I considered praying to be hypocritical. He laughed so much that tears came from his eyes, but he asked me to pray anyway, just say the words, and I did. I was hurting so much, I was willing to do anything, and one day I woke up and I believed in a power greater than me, a loving, caring, higher power became the God of my understanding. I discovered a principle that action comes before feeling. Prayer had to come before belief. To all the slogans we have in NA, I want to add one. The corner it sounds, the better it works. 20 days after I came to NA, I lost my job. My sponsor said that was probably what I needed. I had little to do but hang out with NA members, go to meetings, write my steps, and get involved in service. My recovery motto became, just say yes. Whatever he asked me to do, I said okay. I was willing to go to any lengths. When I was a year clean, I moved to Qatar in the Persian Gulf. Suddenly, I was in a new job in a foreign country and with only 2 meetings a week of AA. The first few months, I spent half my salary calling my sponsor in India. He didn't just tell me stuff. He held my hand and walked me through the day. On some days, minute by painful minute, I'd wake up with a knot of fear in my stomach and just want to die. I'd call my sponsor 3,000 miles away to hear him say, "Have a shower and call me back." I'd call him back and he'd say, "Have breakfast and call me back." I discovered that breakfast is a spiritual principle. With honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, and breakfast, we're well on our way. I'd get to work and be okay for a while. Then the paper would get stuck in the printer and I'd look at the paper and think, what am I printing? What am I even doing here? This is meaningless. I should just kill myself. In those days, I used to go from serene to suicidal in 3 seconds. I couldn't control the feelings. But each time I felt that rage and frustration, I would run to the toilet and spend a lot of time in the toilets, as I did in my using days. Only this time it was for the privacy to pray. My sponsor suggested that I get someone in Qatar to sponsor me. The idea of developing another sponsorship relationship, establishing intimacy with another person, seemed overwhelming. Despite my resistance, I was willing and took action. There was no NA in Qatar, so I asked someone from AA to sponsor me. I worked the steps from the NA step working guides. Every morning, I sat for an hour and wrote answers to the interminable questions. My new sponsor made a copy of the guide and studied it so he could help me. He was a tolerant and humble man. When I looked at what I wrote, it all seemed wrong and meaningless, and I couldn't see what the benefits of all this writing would be. But I know now that's not the point. What was important was the hour I committed to my recovery every day. By doing it every day, I had progressed through the steps, not perfectly, but to the best of my ability. I believe what really helped me was that I was willing. Because there were only 2 meetings a week in Qatar, I started going to NA meetings in internet chat rooms. I even had a service position. I was the secretary of one of the online meetings. Even if no one else showed up, I'd do the meeting protocol, type my share and think, and this is what they call being restored to sanity. A year later, I moved to Oman. it was hard. Moving every year meant building new relationships, trusting new people every time. I found another recovering addict and we started an NA meeting. People started to come to the meetings. My friend, whom I 12-stepped, moved to Oman and we had an NA fellowship. My home became the NA hangout. We met, talked about recovery, had meetings and discussed hospitals and institutions and public information initiatives. I had a sponsee and we worked the steps together. Then I got involved in an unhealthy relationship. I was in Oman, a foreign Islamic country, and the price of getting caught in that relationship was unimaginable, but I could not stop. Once again, I knew the meaning of powerlessness. I felt fear, guilt, and shame, and one of the most precious gifts of recovery slowly disappeared. I no longer felt good about myself. My contact with the God of my understanding was poor. I went to meetings, but I could no longer share honestly. I believed what saved me was sponsorship. I continued to share honestly with my sponsor. I made many attempts to break this obsession, but each time I failed. Finally, my sponsor said, "This is too dangerous for your recovery and for your life. Quit your job and go back to India and start over." I wanted to argue, fight, rant. I had worked hard and did not want to give up my professional success, but I've learned to listen for guidance. That day I went home and prayed, "God, if this is your will for me, then I accept it. But if there is a way, please take this obsession away. I can't do it." The next morning, my boss called me to his office and told me that our company had gotten a big contract in Bahrain and I would have to move immediately. God's solutions have always amazed me. A friend of mine said, "There are no bad days, only good days and learning days. In every situation, I can ask the God of my understanding, what is your will for me? What am I supposed to learn here? I can practice this in all my affairs. Even at work, I can ask, what can I bring to this situation? Rather than what can I take away from it? When I practice this approach, I usually end up a winner." My sponsor made me write about this fascination I had with attached women, my fear of commitment. "The only way to live is to walk through fear. It's time for you to get married," he said. I'd always held up my willingness as a flag. And so I said, "Okay, but it takes two to be married." "Do it the traditional Indian way. Ask your mother to find you a girl," he said. "What about love?" "Love is action," he said. "You learn love. You will propose to a part of the anatomy, but your mother, she will find you a woman with whom you can make a life, spend a lifetime." He also asked me to tell her about my addiction and about NA. I thought that would be the solution. I tell her my war stories and she'd say, "Who the hell wants to marry this maniac?" And that would be that. I could follow my sponsor's direction and I wouldn't have to get married. That was my plan. God's will was obviously different. She heard my story and she was supportive and empathized with me immediately. We were married shortly after. The day before my first wedding anniversary, my wife's bags were packed. She was ready to leave the next morning for good. I remember thinking, "Man, you took the willingness thing too far that time. You shouldn't have gotten married." That evening, I went to a traditions workshop conducted by someone who was visiting. I wasn't really excited by this workshop. I thought of the traditions as dry, but I was miserable and confused, and I thought I would kill some time there. I heard something I will never forget. The person sharing on the first tradition said, "As long as staying clean is more important than getting loaded, you can stay clean. You stay clean. As long as preserving your group is more important than being right, you'll be okay." I went home, hugged my wife, and said, "I'm willing to put in the effort to make this work." From that day, our relationship changed, and I fell in love. I never thought of the traditions as dry again. When I work the 11th step and ask for my sponsor's help, whatever decision I make is the right one. I learned that at the traditions meeting too, at our NA group, a member worried that in his country, where we were likely being watched. Guys who were still using could endanger the meetings. The group discussed the first tradition. Our common welfare must come first. Without the meetings, no one will recover. The third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. The fifth tradition, our primary purpose is to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. I got the opportunity to speak to someone from World Service at a workshop and asked him what decision he would have made without telling him what we'd done. And he said, it doesn't really matter what you eventually decided. I already know you made the right decision because your group used the tools. You had a discussion, talked about the traditions, and then arrived at a decision. It was a huge lesson for me, trust the process. Where I live now, the NA Fellowship is rapidly growing. I don't think I felt as much at home anywhere as I feel here. I shared my intimate secrets with NA and I did not get rejected. So I started to open up even more. Through these relationships, I'm learning intimacy in my other relationships with my wife, my colleagues at work, and my parents. I've learned to trust, make myself vulnerable, and ask for help, especially in things I have had no experience with, from what to do for my wife's birthday to how to make amends to my father. One day at a time, I have come to understand that love is action. I have a life and a partner, and every day I'm faced with choices. I find making decisions hard. They say that with continuing recovery, we will have a clearer idea of who we are and what we want, but it's still not automatic for me. Getting married, moving house, working abroad, in all my big life events, I've been supported and helped by the fellowship. Not only has NA changed me, it has made me comfortable with change.
Thank you so much. Okay, so now we will have our author share submit N from Singapore.
Hi, I'm a grateful addict. My name is Sumit. And thank you, Roger, brother, for doing that. I'm all cried out if just listening to everyone today, to Billy and Tim and Laura and Jorge. It was so emotional and so powerful. And so hopefully I'm not going to cry while I do this. You know, that story was written at the end of 2007. And my life just kept getting better, you know, from the beginning. I'm a grateful addict. And when I say that, you know, what I mean is that, you know, I'm grateful that this happened to me, because otherwise I would have been a serial killer or a sociopath, or it would have manifested in some other way. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic, violent home, and so I thought I would never do this. And I had my first drink 4 days before my 18th birthday, you know, which probably is the latest anybody's ever had any intoxicants. But by 18 and a half, I had tried every drug known to man. And, you know, and it was that first time I was like, why didn't somebody give me this when I was 6 years old? You know, my whole childhood would have been so much better. And you know, that's it. It was the answer to my life. And so, like in that story, when I got here and someone shared and they'd felt like me, I was hooked, you know, because I thought I was completely unique and crazy, and I would just wake up hoping to die most days. So from that first day, I was really, really passionate about NA, and I think Jorge said, you know, I reaped and I sowed, and my life got really better. And in 2008, my son was born, you know, like Tim said, the love of my life. And in 2010, I moved to Singapore and my professional life really took off. I had a lot of success and I was traveling the world, but I was still very, very involved in NA. Whichever city I went to, I would first look up the NA meetings And in the evening, I'd never go out for client dinners and things like that. I was always at the meeting and I loved it, you know, going to new cities. And I mean, the NA guys, the most interesting guys, right? They take you to the best places and hanging out and sharing stories. It was great. And then my story is one of, you know, from desperation to passion to complacency. And I have no, you know, it's I'm going to read it out because it's just expressed best in it's in this passage from Living Clean. And it says, our stories of complacency are much the same. We get lost in work or worship or some other activity, think that NA is stifling or limiting our growth in some way, or that we have grown past this recovery stuff. We lose a sponsor or move and just never reconnect. Sometimes it's a gradual process. We drift away from friends, stop going to meetings, get busy at work, or start developing resentments. A little at a time, we stop working on our recovery and our disease starts gaining a foothold. We can lose everything to a failure of imagination. Thinking that we no longer have to be vigilant about meeting attendance, step work, or sponsorship can lead us to predictable places. I was on the road a lot for work, one member shared, and it stopped being a big deal to not show up. We can't see how addiction is affecting us, especially when the destruction looks different than before. It is possible to lull ourselves to sleep in this program and think we are still awake. The living skills we gain in recovery can become part of our denial structure. It's not that everyone who does this relapses, but it seems that nearly everyone who relapses after staying clean for a while shares this part of the story. And all of that is true for me. You know, I was always a reader, and so I had read all the books and I knew I could quote to you from Just for Today's, and I just knew a lot about the program. But I just started to lose touch, and I had this experience. I worked for a French company, and we took this client to Paris for a trip to meet the, you know, management or whatever. And when you do these trips, you go out a lot and entertain, and you know, they were all drinking, and I wasn't, of course, but and they were telling drinking stories. And I remember the client asked me, "And you don't drink?" And I said, "No, I you know," and I said something about my passion's paragliding, and I said, so I have this shortcut story, which is like one day I went paragliding drunk and I almost died and stopped drinking. And he said, "Oh, I would have stopped paragliding," and we all laughed, and that was it. But that evening we went out to a fancy dinner, and at the end of it, some guy says, "And okay, now to digest all this, we're gonna have a cognac. And you too, Sumit, you'll have one." And I said, "Okay." And so the glass was in front of me and I was gonna pick it up. And this guy, the client who'd been telling all these crazy drinking stories, looks at me and says, "No, you're not drinking that. Not with me anyway. You do that on your own time." And you know, and the moment passed and I survived that. I remember coming back to Singapore and telling Roger that story, and you know, and he was in tears. I mean, about, you know, how our higher power saves us. But you know, the grace of God, we still have to put our hands out to receive it. And a couple of years later, I was on the plane, and by now I had enough success that I was in the front of the plane, and this pretty stewardess came by and she said, "Mr. Noorpuri, would you like a..." And I was seduced by that sophistication. You know, I thought I would impress her. This sounds ridiculous, but you know, this is how our mind can work. And I said, "Yes." And I had that drink. And I remember as I was drinking it, I thought, this doesn't count. It's 30,000 feet. Like, I'm going to not tell anyone. I'm going to pretend it didn't happen. And the next few months were miserable. I didn't tell anyone, but I would, every time I took a plane, I would drink and I would think, what am I doing? And what's wrong with you? And, you know, and I had a wife and a son who'd never seen this, and they still didn't, because I was still doing this on a plane and somehow justifying it. But you know, I had spent way too long here. And by now I was, you know, I suppose secretly, I mean, I had a son, so I don't think I wanted to kill myself, but I suppose I would have been okay if I had to dive in front of a bus and saving a child and die like a hero or something, because I just couldn't bear it. And you know, I knew all the lines. I remember thinking that you can't save your face and ass at the same time. But the thing is, you know, to know the answer to that question, the thing is, when you're not in the meetings, it seems like a question. Do you want to save your face or your ass? Oh, let me think about it, you know? And it wasn't obvious. And it took me some time, and I think 4 or 5 months of this, and I came, you know, because I was, I don't know, it was so, I can't even begin to describe it. I somehow, with this crazy amount of willpower, I just kept it at 2 or 3 drinks, so I didn't create any outward chaos. And that's almost worse, you know, because the outsides were sort of okay, but inside I was dying, like I had never been so bad. And I eventually made it to the meeting, and I shared that. But after that, I couldn't go to the meeting again. You know, when I moved to Singapore, there were only 4 or 5 of us, and I was the old timer, and I was the guy with the story in the book, and I'd spoken at the World Convention, and I couldn't bear to tell them what I'd done. And so I didn't go to meetings. And, you know, this is the insanity of my disease anyway. I thought I could find other ways. And I remember I went to this 10-day silent retreat where you'd meditate from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. and stuff like that, you know. And I mean, I wanted to try everything but NA. And I, once again, you know, I stayed clean 6 months like that without going to meetings. And then I went to some dinner and drank again. And then one day, I went to the meetings, but I wouldn't share that I had, how many days I had. And this guy who sponsored me, you know, we used to do the morning meeting at 7:30 in the morning. And one day we decided to meet at 6:30, you know, before meeting. And I get there at like 6:30 a.m. And this guy, who's the most loving sponsor ever, you know, he's woken up at 5 a.m. or something to meet me. And I'm sitting there thinking, I mean, this is insanity. I'm coming here and lying to him. And I just, you know, blurted out the truth of what I'd been doing. And that was it, you know. And it's actually today. Today I have 1 year. I don't know if Francis planned that, but I have a year clean again. And you know, I was so angry and so bitter and so everything. But, you know, of course, I wouldn't want it to happen quite like that. But I'm not, you know, I'm grateful. I mean, at a year clean, I'm in a way better place than I was at 17 years. That was a guy who, you know, went and used and thought it was a good idea. And really, this year has been, you know, miserable as it's been for so many people. It's been the best year of my life. So it's so weird the way these things work sometimes. But you know, since that day, I showed up for meetings every day, and something's changed. Huh? My wife of 15 years said to me, you know, she said to me, you've changed, like, you know, this intimacy that was talked about so much today and by Billy. And I mean, of course, I as you heard from, saw from my story, I mean, it was, I think it might be the longest story in the book. And I love to talk. And my wife always says, you never say anything. You're very, and I was like, but I talk so much. She said, yeah, you talk so much, but you never actually tell us anything. And that's changed, you know. I think I found intimacy in this year. I mean, that's really my story here. And I'm very, very grateful. You know, I used to say that, you know, I know smarter people than me and kinder people than me and nicer people than me who are dead. And I don't know why I was chosen. And I like to think of it as, you know, the grace of God is there for every one of us, but maybe we just need to put out our hands to receive it. And I was willing to do that and the first time. The second time, you know, I'm truly grateful because... you know, I, I haven't met that many people. I've been coming to meetings for many 20 years, and I haven't met many people who went out and came back. So I know I'm blessed, you know. And I had, I mean, you know, in the first time round, I mean, I wanted to die, you know. I hated my life, but this time I had a lot, you know. I have a 12-year-old son, 5-year-old dog, and my wife for 15 years, and they'd never seen that, you know. They'd always seen just the clean me, and for, I don't know, 13 or 14 of those years, very, very committed. And you know, maybe that's one of the messages, maybe. I don't know, but you know, up to 2015, I was going to the prison. You know, I was taking meetings to the prison. And I guess that's it, you know, just because at 15 years, because I had my story in the book, or because I spoke at a world convention, or because I took meetings to the prison, I still need to work it today. You know, I don't know. I guess I thought I had some kind of guarantee, and I missed the point, you know, that it was just for today. And, but yeah, I found a different, you know, this is what my higher power had. I mean, I don't know if, you know, I made the choice. We make these choices, but today I'm glad I made the choice to come back and to step into the action. And I have found a deeper relationship. My routine these days, I there's a morning meeting at 7:30 every weekday, and I walk to it, and it's an hour's walk. And normally on that walk, I pray and meditate, and sometimes I call friends who are, you know, in America, Australia, where it's a good time of the day. And then I go to the meeting, and then I hang out with the guys, and then I kind of start my day at 10 a.m. And I try to do that, to take like 3 or 4 hours before I start, because I feel like I need that now. And yeah, and that's where I am.
Sorry, Sumit, you're muted.
I was done. I was going to say thank you. You know, I love you all, and thank you, Francis, for everything you do, and I'm really grateful, and I'm very excited. I don't know whether you chose that or where it was, but it's so nice to be able to do this at 9 a.m. on the day of my first year of 1 year clean. So thank you.
Thank you. Everybody help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yay. So much.
Thank you.